Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. We begin with a diplomatic flare-up with China, which has reacted angrily to a joint Australia-US statement calling for an end to its land building on islands and reefs in the South China Sea and reasserting the right of other nations to navigate through the area. China has called the statement not responsible and not constructive. In a statement to the ABC, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the Chinese embassy in Canberra accused both Australia and the United States of lighting a fire that will add fuel to the flames. The South China Sea covers the key shipping lanes and vast gas and oil wealth, and China has been competing with other Southeast Asian nation states for influence in the region for years. It's escalated its claim by creating islands out of the ocean, putting military structures on some of them. Tim Palmer speaks next to Bill Gates from the U.S. Study Center at Sydney University.
How would you describe the wording of this Chinese response?
Well, it is rather strong coming out of the embassy in Canberra. I think we should wait to see whether the officials, you know, the full spokesman of the foreign ministry in Beijing issues something equally powerful. But that'll probably come later tomorrow. It's important, I think, to note for context that the statement which Osman made regarding the South China Sea was just one of several others in a much broader and sweeping set of points that are made about international security and the overall discussion which the foreign minister and the defense minister had with their counterparts in the United States. But nevertheless, China basically saying, don't meddle in this issue. It's none of your business.
Is there anything specific about the call to end reclamation that particularly rankles with Beijing, going to the point that this response from China calls it a double standard from Australia and the United States? Where's the double standard?
I think the thing that really rankles Beijing is that two countries, Australia and the United States, who are not claimants territorially to any of the islands in the region and who have remained neutral, in fact, about those various territorial claims. But by making a statement, nevertheless, China sees this as sort of intervention where they do not belong. The double standard, then, I think, in their statement is, in their view, that while the United States and Australia claim to seek stability and peace in the region, in China's view, this type of statement coming out of Osman undermines that and creates more problems rather than solving them. So in their view, China's view, that's a double standard.
While Julie Bishop said this morning that Australia hadn't agreed to the idea of joint US-Australian naval patrols in the disputed areas, would the idea that such patrols are even being discussed be another irritant to China?
It certainly would be, and I think we can presume behind closed doors that such discussions do take place. That doesn't mean they'll happen. There's just simply discussion about them. And in a sense, this very strongly worded statement coming out of the embassy in Canberra may well be a kind of warning shot that, you know, saying making comments about the South China Sea issue is one thing. Actually, joining together in joint patrols to try and assert freedom of navigation in the region would be something quite different. And yes, we could expect an even stronger reaction from China were that to actually take place.
Where does this level of sensitivity come from? What's at stake in this part of the South China Sea?
You know, first and foremost, for China, this is a sovereignty issue. They claim against a lot of international opprobrium and disagreement that the entire South China Sea, a huge swath of maritime territory, belongs to China. And so any effort to question that, seek that China go to international arbitration, or that tries to push China into negotiating off of that position is going to be met with a lot of resistance by the Chinese. Yes, beyond the sovereignty issue, obviously there are fisheries, there are potentially large deposits of energy in that part of the world, and it would have a geostrategic strength, given that so much of the international maritime traffic between the Middle East and to the northeast of Asia passes through that region. So there is a lot at stake, but fundamentally it's really about China's claim that this area is theirs and others should not be meddling.
Certainly sets up a diplomatic tightrope for Australia. Bateskill, thanks for joining us.
Beijing describes the moves by Australia and the U.S. to the deepening naval cooperation as muscle flexing that raises tensions in the South China Sea. The U.S. and Australia have criticized China's island building in the disputed area and agreed to further develop naval ties in Asia. American Defense Secretary Ashton Carlton has also vowed U.S. ships and planes will sail and fly wherever international law allows, in a clear rebuff to Beijing's sovereignty claims. China correspondent Bill Bertels has the story.
China's government has become increasingly accustomed to criticism from Washington about its island-building program in the South China Sea. But the news that Australia's foreign and defence ministers had joined their American counterparts in raising concerns drew a firm response. China's foreign ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying told reporters that Beijing isn't to blame for increasing tensions.
However, there are some countries who deploy weapons in waters near these islands and keep flexing their muscles. There are other factors that are escalating tension in these waters. We hope that this country can stop hyping up the tension and stick to their commitments that they will not take sides in relevant issues.
China's vast territorial claim over the South China Sea and its program of dredging sand to create artificial islands on some of the reefs has already prompted American surveillance flights. Now the US is weighing up whether to sail naval ships close to islands in the Spratly Archipelago. During the ministerial talks in Boston, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop said Australia is on the same page as the US in advocating freedom of navigation. But she was careful to point out China's President Xi Jinping recently vowed not to build up China's military presence in the sea. Hua Chunying has reiterated that theme.
Our construction activities are mainly to serve civil needs and to fulfill our international obligations, that is to provide more public goods and services. As for our defense needs, it's easy to understand. We can all see that some countries keep flexing their muscles and they are holding frequent military drills in these waters. It is justified to hold a necessary military defense facilities.
The comments from China's foreign ministry weren't quite as strong as an earlier statement issued by the embassy in Canberra, which accused Australia and the US of lighting a fire and adding fuel to the flames. It also accused the two countries of applying a double standard. A total of six countries have overlapping territorial claims in the South China Sea, which has major trade routes and is believed to be rich in undersea resources.
That was Bill Bertels reporting from Beijing. Well, the long-awaited report on what happened to MH17, the Malaysian Airlines flight that was shot down over Ukraine, has been released. The tragedy confirms what Australia has maintained from the onset, but there are still questions to be answered. In Question Time in Australia this week, the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, described the findings of the Dutch Safety Board as another important step in the healing process. He reaffirmed his government's commitment to bring those responsible to justice. But legal experts are warning of challenges ahead. Thomas Orty reports.
It's an important step forward, but there's a long journey ahead. That appears to be the consensus on both sides of Australian politics, 15 months on from the MH17 tragedy. And while Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says he hopes the findings of the Dutch Safety Board help to bring some closure, they largely come as no surprise.
It confirms what Australia has maintained since the outset, that flight MH17, a passenger jet carrying 298 people, 38 of them Australian, was shot down by a Russian-made Buk surface-to-air missile system. The missile was fired from within a 320-square-kilometre area in the eastern Ukraine, then occupied by Russian-backed separatist forces.
In Question Time, the Prime Minister described the event as a shocking crime, set against the continuing geopolitical aftershocks of the collapse of the Soviet Union. But it was also a deeply personal tragedy, with victims from 10 countries, 193 of them from the Netherlands alone.
We and all the nations whose citizens share our grief are determined to do everything we can, no matter how long it takes, to identify those responsible and bring them to justice.
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, was equally determined.
This report tells us more of the mechanics of the MH17 tragedy, the how, but not who perpetrated this atrocity or why. These questions deserve answers, and the answers must lead to justice.
That path to justice seems to be leading towards Russia. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk blames the downing of MH17 on Russian special intelligence services. And Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop has accused Russia of seeking to discredit the investigation. That's been echoed by her opposition counterpart Tanya Plibersek.
I think the Russian government and the makers of this missile system should stop pretending that this is a politically motivated investigation. This is a very serious and credible report.
The Russian government admits it has problems with the Dutch Safety Board's report. Alexander Orievsky is the second secretary at the Russian embassy in Canberra.
We disagree about the outcomes to which the Dutch authorities, the Dutch investigators arrived. And these are two things. We disagree with the qualification of a missile, which they think caused downing MH17. And we disagree with the location that they name and they think the missile was launched from.
He refers to two field tests conducted by the missile manufacturer, one using a current version of the missile and another using an older model. The tests found that the damage to MH17 could only have been caused by the older model. Both Russia and Ukraine had that model, but it was decommissioned in the Russian military about 14 years ago. Alexander Orievsky wouldn't comment about whether one of the older missiles could have ended up in the hands of Russian rebels.
It is those who used this missile or who pushed the button. This has to be established and clarified. We propose total cooperation. Russian experts, Russian intelligence, Russian military has always engaged in the investigation, but we are not satisfied how this investigation was conducted.
Legal experts are quick to point out that Russia vetoed a UN Security Council tribunal. Associate Professor Gideon Boas from Monash University was a senior legal officer at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
That leaves several options open. One of those options is a multilateral treaty between a number of interested states, including Ukraine and Australia, of course, and others. That has all sorts of jurisdictional problems, particularly if any of those who are identified as potential accused are Russian citizens. If you can't get some sort of multilateral treaty-based tribunal, there could be an endeavour to prosecute individuals under national law, most particularly Ukrainian law, although there are obvious difficulties associated with that.
And at the National Press Club this afternoon, Qantas CEO Alan Joyce suggested that intelligence sharing could have prevented the tragedy.
Some airlines were not flying over that part of Ukraine because they had the assessment and the security information to say that wasn't an appropriate thing to do.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A new report in Fiji is calling for a more central role for Pacific women in policy and decision-making. The executive director of FemLink Pacific says the Policy for Peace report complies the recommendations of Pacific women leaders for peace, security, and gender. Sharon Bhagwan Rolls says the policy initiative aligns these visions with international instruments such as the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325. This resolution looks at the impact of war on women and recognizes the important role women play in managing and resolving conflict and achieving sustainable peace. She speaks next to Corey Hawkins.
This has been part of our network's efforts way back since 2007, when we realized that in addition to the voice and visibility through our media initiatives, we also needed to start documenting our own policy recommendations as Pacific women to feed into global processes, but also in terms of localizing or making relevant what is being discussed on the global agenda. So this is almost the eighth or ninth publication for us, and it is in terms of the framework of the global study, having been part of the advisory group for Radhika Kumaraswamy, who has authored the global study. But in terms of our own specific recommendations, it's also looking at what we've just discussed, the achievements, the challenges, but also some clear recommendations in terms of enhancing participation in every level of decision-making, from the local level, local governance, village, provincial councils, as well as national parliaments, but also in terms of national security policy issues. It's also about some of the unfinished business in terms of demilitarization. It's also in terms of looking forward so that as part of the process, we also ensure that there's a diversity taken into account when we talk about peace and security.
Now, in terms of the review of 1325, from a Pacific perspective, what is working and what needs to change?
Well, what has worked was obviously that we had some momentum following the 10th anniversary, where we saw the UN system with regional intergovernmental organizations, both the SBC and the Pacific Islands Forum, and women from our own network and other rights activists coming together for the development of the Pacific Regional Action Plan. What hasn't worked is, while we had this high-level adoption by forum leaders, while we had the engagement with the member states of the SBC, which include the 22 Pacific Island countries and territories, it's been very slow in terms of translating these regional commitments into national action. Although we have seen some integration, for example, into the Papua New Guinea National Security Plan. And I think in terms of that, it's about how do we ensure that these types of partnerships, particularly with regional intergovernmental organizations, don't just get limited to formal meetings, but that we're part of an ongoing engagement. And I'm hoping that as the forum comes out of its new approach following its review, it will recognize that women have to be part of the peace and regional peace and security agenda. I think one of the other limitations is clearly the fact that in terms of development aid or resourcing, there hasn't been specifically funds tagged for peace and security work. So even for our network, in the 15 years, we've sustained the work, but it's always been about how do we resource peace and security? How do we resource peace building? But particularly from a preventative perspective, because that requires long-term engagement and sustained work.
For the average Pacific woman in a garden, going to the market, selling fish by the sea, why should they care about these sort of agreements and these policies?
They should really care, because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that every single one of our national budgets are taking our security into account, not a militarized security perspective. So we need to care, we need to understand where are national budgets going in terms of our security, whether it's the streetlights, whether it's the access to water, whether it's infrastructure like roads and communication. And so that's one thing in terms of the national agenda. But very much at the local level, I think Pacific women every day are working so hard to sustain, build peaceful communities, to prevent conflicts, yet we're not in those decision-making processes which are closely linked to development plans that can enable them to say, no, if we take this approach, there's a greater chance that we won't have the kind of conflicts that we're experiencing, whether it's in our homes or whether it's in our community or whether it's with another group. So women, we should no longer just say, yes, we're peace builders and that's it. We need to be actively involved in the decision making, and whether that's in your home, whether it's in your village community, your local center, or whether it's a national parliament, participation is so closely linked to peace.
New Zealand's Institute of Atmospheric Research is forecasting an increase in the number of strength of cyclones in the Southwest Pacific this cyclone season. With its strongest El Nino in 60 years, NIWA scientists are predicting up to 13 cyclones in the next 6 months. and which could hit some of the strongest storms ever, up to a Category 5, with winds, that is, reaching 200 kilometers an hour. Its principal scientist, Chris Brandolino, spoke to Jim Mora.
Generally speaking, when you look at an average or a typical year, the 30-year average from 81 to 2010 says that 10.4 named tropical cyclones, that's Category 1 or higher, occur in the Southwest Pacific Basin, again, on average, during a tropical cyclone season. This year, we're tipping between 11 and 13 named storms, so that's elevated. We're also expecting six Category 3 tropical cyclones, and four of those, of that six, four may reach at least Category 4 strength. So the message here is that there's an elevated risk for increased activity and for increased intense tropical cyclones.
Possibilities of Category 5?
Yes, there is an increased likelihood of multiple Category 4 or 5 systems.
Chris, I know you say guidance, not gospel, but can I ask you for a few specifics, even if they're best guesses? Which islands in the Pacific are at greatest risk, do you think?
Vanuatu is up there. Wallace and Futuna is up there. Let's see here. Also looking at Samoa. That's an elevated risk. Also over towards Society Islands. Northern Cooks. Those are areas that have an elevated risk. It should be noted that the elevated risk exists both early season and late season. However, when you kind of break it down, the focus for the elevated risk is situated closer to the dateline, say north of Fiji, early in the season for the first 3 months. And that fits our narrative quite well because as we speak, up to the north, north of Fiji, there's some disturbed weather. There's some unsettledness. There's showers, thunderstorms, spinning air. There's a possibility we could see some tropical development over the next couple of days. As the season unfolds, while the risk remains elevated, the focus will tend to shift farther east toward French Polynesia as we enter the last 3 months of the tropical cyclone season.
And finally on the program, the Cook Islands House of Ariki says people should strengthen family relationships to avoid court disputes over land ownership. Up to 24 high chiefs from various islands belong to the parliamentary body and provide feedback on policy issues such as the permanent residence and preserving traditions. The clerk of the house, Punnant Rakini, told Danielle Metada Cox, land use and ownership often spark family arguments.
We are urging them, one, to connect with their families, nuclear families, extended families, the clans, the tribes. Talk amongst yourself. There are problems. They have family issues. But come on, strengthen our traditional family structures so that when it comes to dealing with land, we don't argue over it. We can easily say, yes, you can use the land. When you finish, bring it back to the family. The other potential solution is for those who are living abroad to give their power of attorney to somebody in the Cook Islands so that only one person can speak on behalf of, say, 50, 100 people, rather than spending a lot of money searching for all the landowners to get their consent. We haven't got that capacity. Our people in the Cook Islands haven't got the capacity. So, again, the whole idea is to bring our people together, see what difficulties they have, and share what we believe are issues in the Cook Islands that they need to know. I know a couple of people, they tried to apply for more than a quarter of an acre under vesting orders. That was thrown out of court. So it's difficult. I am entitled to more than a quarter of an acre. Why am I restricted to a quarter of an acre? Go to the court, and the court will say, no, you are only entitled under the vesting order to a quarter of an acre.
How do you know how much you're entitled to?
Because the land in the Cook Islands, in most islands, except for Mangaia, Mitiaro, and Pukapuka, have already been determined. The shares on most of those islands have been determined. Some areas in Rarotonga are still to be investigated. So I know what shares my family own and what my grandmother own. So it is easy for the families to determine what their shares are.
So who determined it in the first place?
It's already been determined by the court. There were surveys conducted, there were investigations of titles in the past. and determination of shares were done in the past to most lands. And I don't know whether that was a good thing. In Mitiaro, Mangaia and Pukapuka, it didn't happen.
What did they do there?
They are still under our traditional customary practices, where if they need land, they don't have any land, they go to the Yariki and ask. And the Yariki says, you go and build over there. They can't do that. They are well protected by the authority of the Yariki without any writing, nothing in black and white. And once they say they have, there's no more issues from that particular person, then the land automatically reverts back to the Yariki for the Yariki to decide what to do with it. So there are problems with that one too, but it seems to be a little bit more simpler to apply than what we are in today.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, have any comments or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. A special thanks goes to ABC Radio Australia. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping that you can catch the weekly edition and also 3-time daily edition on our various frequencies. And by the way, you can also get the FAP QSO card, the new one that we have, for the end of the year. I'm not going to tell you what's on the design yet, but you'll have to write in and you see it for yourself. Anyway, that's all we have time for. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.